The story starts, and this is just a story. I'm not going to give you a passage. You'll figure out where the passage is as we go along, but I just want to tell you a story. We focus in on, and you can see if you look closely, a crippled man. He's in a very rudimentary, kind of an ancient history kind of makeshift wheelchair. He's living in a little cabin of a guy named Mashir. It's not even his own house. He can't afford his own house. It's out in the middle of nowhere. He's living a miserable existence miles away from the nearest people. It's the village called Lo Debar. It's down below in the middle kind of where the Jordan River flows. And the name means no pasture land. And everything in the world of that time revolves around agriculture. And if you're living in the middle of no pasture land, it means that this is a place where you can't raise a crop, you can't raise animals, and so you're kind of a meager existence out in the middle of nowhere. So he's in poverty, and he's crippled. It's kind of like you're living in Alaska, the remotest parts. And when you know, I understand people who've moved to Alaska, the first thing people say to them is, "What are you running from?" You know, because you're trying to get away from something. Lo Debar is where you go when you want nobody to find you and nobody to know where you are. It's a hideout, and that's exactly what he needs. It's an awful place, but that's where he needs to be to not be discovered. He's bitter and he's resentful, living off a memory of the past that's getting every day older and older and older. He recalls greater days, but they were way back there, and the memory is getting distant, and the taste is no longer in his mouth. He was a grandson of the king, even in line potentially to be another king in the dynasty. He was living in the palace of his grandfather, where his father also lived. He was the envy of all the other kids around him. He had free rein to do whatever he wanted to. He ate like a king. He lived like a king. He was treated like a king, because he was a grandchild of the king. But that's an ancient memory. He's living off of it the best he can. And it's bitter. He now has a wife. He now has some children. He still doesn't have his own house. And he's living in the middle of nowhere. His grandfather, the most powerful man in the land, king of Israel, he was a head taller than most people. He started off really strong, and the people rallied around him, and he was able to give them victory. But before long, he was at crossways with God, and God had already decided, "You're not the man to lead my people, and so I'm going to choose someone else. I'm going to choose someone after my own heart." And he's already had David anointed. So everybody knew that Saul's days were numbered, and they also knew who the replacement would be. So David had become public enemy number one. Saul pulled out all the stops. He chased after David and tried to kill him. A source of tension in this situation is the fact that Saul's own son was David's best friend. And despite the fact that Saul hated David, Jonathan loved David. And they were the best of friends. Made for very tense family reunions. Of course, who likes family reunions anyway, right? We don't like those cousins anyhow. But these family reunions became places of tension as their differences were on public display. And, of course, the Philistines also. Philistines were the enemies of Israel, and they're constantly causing Saul all sorts of trouble. And one day they came and they threatened Saul, and Saul and two of his sons were killed on the top of Mount Gilboa, including Jonathan, this young man's father, this crippled man's father. You see what happens every year in April, they do, like you do a tornado drill. You should do tornado drills here. You did one on a Tuesday night the last time I was here. We were meeting in these rooms back here. It's kind of a weird thing. Never had that happen before or since. Kind of interesting. We do that in public schools, and we do intruder drills, and we do fire drills and all that stuff. What they would do is a dynasty drill. When a politician, the king who was running the nation, died, and the replacement comes in, the other family members of that other king that's been replaced go into hiding, because the first thing the replacement king does is he goes hunting the relatives of the previous king. In case they ever thought of raising this revolt, of rising up and retaking the throne, you just wipe them all out. And so what you do when the king dies is all the family members go into hiding. And so when the news hits the press that the king had died on Mount Gilboa and two of his sons, and that that someone else was going to be king, most likely David, when all the dust settles, the nanny knew what to do. the nanny who had this young boy who became this crippled man. And so she picked up this little boy, and she starts running down the stairs and across the moat and into the wilderness where the hiding place would be. But as she ran, she fell on this boy, broke both of his legs, and they didn't have time to set the bones. And so he became permanently impaired. And they go find him a secret place to live in so that he wouldn't be considered a threat by anybody else. That's the story. That's what happened. And now here he is years later in the home of Mashir, someone else, in Lodibar, a crippled man who, if he ever thought about rising up and claiming what he thought was his, those powerless legs reminded him he couldn't do it. If he ever thought about going and allying with somebody else who could do it, the fact that he was an enemy of the king kept him from doing it. So now here he is, surrounding this table, in the home of Mashir in Lodibar, miserable but safe. And while those nightmares had afflicted him for years, they're pretty much gone. He doesn't think David has any concern for him anymore. You ever thought what life on the run would be like when you're hiding from the authorities that be, like witness protection or something? You ever thought about that? Change your name, change your identity, and try not to be discovered. You don't want to be identified? A man named Don in New Jersey found out what this was like when he lived this riotous teenage life. He had all these things against him, all these tickets and all these citations against him, and they were still on his record, and because of that he couldn't find a good job, but he was too afraid to go check it out. So he had all these records against him. And so he hides out in rural places. He gets jobs for cash only because he can't get a job. They'll do a background check and he'll nobody hire him for that. Janet's the same way. She did the same thing. Parking tickets galore, and because of that, she doesn't have any idea whether she's safe to be out or not. So she kind of lives on the outskirts and meets people in different places. And then there's a policeman in South Africa. The days of apartheid, when all these powerful people took their power to abusive measures, he decided he'd show off the authority he has, and he goes to this one house, and he takes this 18-year-old boy, and he kills him. He puts him in a barbecue grill and turns him over for a long time in the yard where he lived. He returns 8 years later, still under apartheid. He returns 8 years later, and he gets the father, and he pours gasoline on him, makes the wife watch, and he lights this guy up and kills him in the front yard. And now when he'd like to go back and change things, but he can't, Nelson Mandela is let out of prison, he becomes the president, and he's vowing for justice, and he's vowing for healing and reconciliation, and he's terrified. What are people going to do to me in the atmosphere of our land right now? There are people who know this feeling of being powerless enemies, scared to death of being discovered. And by the way, maybe you should know this feeling too. Let me give you some scriptures here. You were once alienated from God, were enemies in your mind because of your evil deeds. You were powerless, Romans chapter 5, verse 6. You were dead in your transgressions and sins in which you used to live when you followed the ruler, when you followed the course of this world and the ruler of the air. You were objects of God's wrath. Having sinned, you've fallen short of the glory of God. Now, who are these verses about? Who is he speaking of in these verses? When he writes this language of powerless and enemies and in wrath of God, and he's hunting you down, and you are in the crosshairs of God's wrath, who's he writing about? Let me answer it for you. You. He's writing about you, and he's writing about me and everyone who ever lived. Now you want to pause here and say, hold a time out. That's who I used to be. Yes. Tonight you can praise God. You can sing these songs tonight really loud. Why? Because you know that's who you used to be. But some of you here tonight, I bet, I would wager, you're still there. These verses still describe you. You are an enemy of God. The moment you ever sin, no matter how minor that sin may be in your eyes, the moment you sin, you become an enemy of God. His wrath is put on you, and he's after you, and you are powerless to do anything about it. You're completely helpless because once you sin, you can't possibly get back in his good graces again. And so you are in deep trouble. You are on the run, and it's a matter of time before God gets you, and he puts you in where all people go who are under his wrath. You're storing up wrath for the day of judgment, Romans chapter 2. You know what that's like. Now, those of you maybe who've changed, and you can celebrate the fact you're no longer like that, you do have to still acknowledge you once were there. That's who you were. And some of you still are. So we go back to that crippled man and look at him sitting at that table in Lodi Bar. But we need to go back a little bit before that. David knew that Saul had issued these threats against him. He knew that Saul hated his guts and was looking for any opportunity and any chance he had to take David out. But he still loved Saul's son. He didn't want to do anything that would hurt him. He didn't want to do anything that would reflect poorly on him. There's this APB out on David. But Jonathan, who knows that, doesn't honor it. So he asked Jonathan, will you help me find out just how intense Saul's hatred is? Am I just being paranoid? Am I making this up? Or is this really thing? Is he really after my life? So if you will, go to the family reunion and you tell me. You mention it. You talk to your dad about it and tell me if I need to go on the run or not. And Jonathan said, I will. And I'll be honest with you. I won't lie with you. I won't lie to you, right? So he does, and he finds out it's every bit as bad as David thought. Saul would love to kill David. So he goes out in that field, you know about the arrows and sending that servant. And at the end of it, he says, you need to go on the run. But they make this covenant. Now listen, they're out in the middle of nowhere. No one else can hear the covenant. No one else can hear the conditions of it. But here's what he says. Jonathan looks at David and says, I'm going to help you all I can, but show me unfailing kindness as long as I live. Don't ever cut off your kindness from my family, even when the Lord has cut off all your enemies, including my father. They make this covenant. David honors it happily. Saul was dangerous, but Saul died. David takes the throne. He comes out victorious. He comes out on top. The battles are all fought. Everything is on. When the dust settles, there's David on the throne. And he's walking around the palace with no competitors, with nobody threatening his position, no one denying he should be there. And as he's walking around, he starts asking a question of all the cabinet members and all the people he's got around him. And they get shifty-eyed and they get nervous and they start stammering and stuttering because they're afraid of what this question means. This king, who's now taken over the throne, says to the people, is there anybody left from the house of Saul? Guys, are you aware of Saul having any genetic relatives at all? And they're all thinking, oh man, we just got peace. We all got this settled. Don't go out and start slaughtering people. It's not necessary. But David has something else in mind. Nobody's used to this. Nobody's used to this kind of faithfulness. The word chesed, a Hebrew word, appears all the way through this text that we're on. And it's a word that wraps up. I think the prayer leaders here are amazing. The prayer this morning was amazing. Some of the words he said, I'm still thinking. I've been thinking about them today. And then tonight, when he talks about God's loving kindness and generosity and grace toward us, all those words, generosity, kindness, and grace, you wrap them all up and it's the Hebrew word chesed. It doesn't have an equivalent in English, but it's all those words and more. So David's about to show what grace looks like. I'm about to demonstrate grace on the order of what God does for us. And so he started asking these questions and everybody's getting shifty and they're going, oh no, we don't want to say anything. Nobody knows. So they get this old servant of Saul. His name is Ziba. And they get Ziba to come to David and David looks at him and he says, is there anybody left? Anybody at all in the family line of Saul? Now here's the amazing thing. Ziba never tells a name. Ziba never says, well, yeah, there's so-and-so. What he says is, I'm going to give you a description of him. Number one, there is a son of Jonathan. That's even better. Not only is it in line with Saul, but it's the actual son of Jonathan, his best friend. This is a good thing, right? He's a son of Jonathan, and he's appealing to the friendship that David and Jonathan shared. So yes, there is a son of Jonathan. Second, he's a crippled man. I want you to know right now, if you're evaluating his level of threat to you, he is not a threat. Leave him alone. He's a cripple. He's not going to bother you. Don't go after him. Don't go hunting him down. He's not trying to find you. You don't need to find him. Ziba is saying, leave this alone. But he doesn't know what David's doing. First of all, he's a son of Jonathan. Second, he's a crippled man. Number three, he's in Lodibar. He's far, far away. He's not mounting any kind of threat. They don't go to Lodibar to, you know, to threaten the king. They don't do that. That's not where you have political unrest. He never says his name. It's inconsequential as he is, powerless and far away. But David is not looking to kill anybody. What David is doing is showing grace. Forget the trouble that Saul cost him. David is going to honor his covenant word. And so the scene shifts back to Lo-Debar, where this crippled man is gathered around this table in the home of Machir. Just call him Mac if you want to. I like that. Mac is a lot easier. He's in Mac's house, and he's gathered around the table, and there's a knock at the door. And he's, so somebody goes and opens the door, and there's a whole line of the king's armored men standing there. Now, he's had a nightmare of this for years, but it's kind of gone away because his level of threat is so low. But here the king's men say, you've been summoned to the capital. David's not with them. You've been summoned to the capital. And so there they mount him up on this wagon and they take him up to the capital city. A lot of people would be excited, but it feels sort of like a procession to him. He may be being taken out right now. And they bring him into the very room where David is. And there's David on his throne. And they bring this man to the feet of David. And finally, after all this time, David says the first word is his name. He doesn't look at him and say, hey, crippled man. Nope. He doesn't say, hey, powerless guy. Nope. He doesn't even say, hey, dude from D-Bar. He doesn't say that. He looks at him and he gives him the dignity and worth of speaking his name, Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, you are here. This is your home. Don't be afraid. This is not a bad day. This is a great day for you. And then he says three things. I'm going to show you covenant grace for the sake of your father, Jonathan. This is not about you, Mephibosheth. It's not about you. It's about your father. Remember that. It's not about you. It's about your father. Remember that, church. I will restore to you all the land that your grandfather Saul owned. That was a lot of land. And you're going to eat at my table for the rest of your life. Speechless. It's not what he expected at all. It's not how the dream ever went, right? What is your servant you should notice a dead dog like me? I love that because he just is very honest with himself. You remember when we used to sing that song, For Such a Worm as I? Do you remember when we said that? Now it's one. They've changed it to one because it sounds a little more dignified. I like worm. Really, to be honest with you, that's really more descriptive of our value apart from Christ, isn't it? We're not one, we're a worm, right? That's what he says, what am I? I'm a servant, I'm your servant, but what am I? A dead dog, why do you even care about me? Oh, that's just, you'll find out in a minute. He put Ziba in charge of all these rewards and gives it to him. And suddenly the life and the mentality of a powerless cripple is changed to the status from enemy to being a person taking up the life of privilege as a child of the king. What would that be like? Would it be like winning the lottery? I'll never know. But would it be like that? How about Publishers Clearing House? Maybe that's better. Right. Or maybe a royal wedding in England. Does anybody get up at 4 o'clock to watch those stupid things? Maybe you do. I know people who do. Something's wrong with them. Don and Janet found out about this. In New Jersey, they came up with this new plan, and it's in a lot of states now. It's called Operation Safe Surrender. And what it does is these people who are a little uncertain, but they know that there's some things that they've got on their record that's against them, they can come, and they can. It can't be murder, it can't be a felony, but those who have a lot of those other things that they're afraid of, that are holding them back from their future, if they'll come to Operation Safe Surrender, they'll translate those into community service. You work them off, and your record is expunged, and you can go on without being harassed by your past. What a beautiful plan for that, right? But every time they planned it, they said, come to the police station, and it's Operation Safe Surrender, and you know, nobody showed up. Can you figure out why? This is a prank. You know what they started doing? They started going to churches saying, would you host this? Would you sponsor this? Because they'll trust you as a church. They're used to going to church to get pardon, and so they will here. And so they started coming to churches for Operation Safe Surrender, and it traded your offenses for public service, and you walked away scot-free. It's a beautiful thing. And Don and Janet found out about this. This policeman in South Africa, what Nelson Mandela set up was the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. It's the first of its kind. There's been other nations do this since then. And here's what he decided to do. We're never going to get justice for all this. And if you aren't safe, you'll not tell the truth. And we need the truth more than anything else. Truth and reconciliation. You can't have reconciliation without truth. You got to tell the whole thing. So here's what we're going to do. We will not prosecute you. You will not have to pay the penalty of your crimes, but you do have to face the people you offended. You do have to fess up and say it all. You got to speak it all. And if you'll speak it all, you'll be forgiven completely. So this policeman decides, that's my only way to freedom. And so he stands in this courtroom, and this woman, the mother, and the wife of the husband, the mother of the child that was killed, and she stood there. And she listened as he told the gruesome story. And he told it all, every detail, weeping because he realized with a broken heart he had really messed up. Now the judge says, okay, you've told the truth. Are you satisfied? The woman says, yes. What do you want to say to him? And the woman looked at him, and all these emotions, as you can imagine, running through her. And she says, I want you to gather the ashes of my husband that remain in the yard, and I want you to give him an honorable burial. Nodded his head. She said, I'm no longer a mother. I've got a big heart, though, and a lot of love to give. So 2 days a month for the rest of your life, you come to my house, and I'm going to treat you as my son. Now, that was weird. And then she said, I want you to know God forgives you and I forgive you, and I want you to come and embrace me right now. And he never made it. He walked halfway across the room and fainted in the floor. Can you imagine carrying that burden around with you and suddenly it's completely, instantly removed? That's really what happens with us. And I can't imagine anything as intense as his feeling, but I can imagine because of this passage, these passages, because these are kind of like the second half of those passages I read just a moment ago. He has now reconciled you in the body of his flesh by his death in order to present you holy and blameless. You go from being a powerless enemy with the wrath of God targeted right on you like a red button from a gun, right? You go from that to being holy and blameless and above reproach and spotless and clean, just like that. That's amazing, and that's grace, and that's good news. While you were still powerless, Christ died for you. Since therefore you've now been justified by his blood, how much more shall you be saved from the wrath of God? Or by God being rich in grace, but God being rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ even when we're dead in our transgressions. The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life. If you are no longer described as a powerless enemy of the king, deserving only his wrath, you are now children of the king. It's because of his grace that that change took place. If you still have that target on you, that grace is available at any time, so long as you do it in your lifetime. Don't die in your sin. Don't die in your rebellion and in your wrath. It's not a real stretch to say that we are Mephibosheth. The words to describe him in the text of 2 Samuel 9 also describe us throughout the New Testament. What David did for him is what God does for us. Now, how in the world does that happen? And it is explained in the text. The promise that benefited Mephibosheth was made long before he was conceived, long before any trouble that anything he did could create. It's a promise between friends based on his father's actions, not so much on his. The promise was made before the trouble he would cause came up. And that's true of us. God made a promise to Abraham, Father Abraham. He made a promise to him based on faith. Long before the trouble that our sin would create, he made a promise that benefited us. And he still honors it today for anyone who has the faith of Abraham. Through the seed, Christ. And it's because of a promise he made to someone else. So when Mephibosheth says, who am I? It's a really good question, because the truth is, it's not about you at all. It's about your father. Your salvation is not just so you can sit there and say, well, look how good I am, or look at how... It's to brag about your father and what his plan is. And what is the response that he says, I am your servant? I have no idea why God loves us the way he does. I have no idea why he goes to such trouble for us, for you, for me. But I do know that the proper response is to say, I'm your servant. I will do whatever you say. I want to take you back in time one last time. This is a scene painted by Charles Swindoll, and I've just changed it just a little bit. See if you can figure out the details of this. The meal is ready in the palace of the king. The table is set. It's wonderfully decorated with great food, much like your potluck, which had endless food today. The dinner bell rings. It's time to come and devour it. And David, as the king at the head of the table, takes his place. And the family slowly comes from different areas. The first one to come to the table and take his place where his table setting is already waiting for him is a clever and crafty son who playfully enters the room and takes the seat to David's left. This is Amnon. The second is the lovely and the beautiful and the gracious, bright and beautiful daughter of David who sits next to him, to Amnon, and that's Tamar. So you got David, and then you got Amnon, and you got Tamar. The third is a brilliant, preoccupied son who is so smart, he's coming from the area of the library. You figured out who this is yet? His nose is in a book, and he's spouting some facts that nobody cares about. And he puts it down in time to take his place as the heir apparent of David. His name is Solomon. The fourth is a handsome and winsome young man with long hair that flows down to his shoulders. And every time he enters a room, he gets absolute attention from everybody. It's Absalom. And then, of course, you have Bathsheba taking her place. It looks like a family straight out of a reality TV show. These are blemish-free, totally beautiful, wealthy people, right? There isn't a blemish anywhere on them. And these people obviously belong in a place like this, but we're not done yet. There is the shuffling of feet. It sounds like Sam when he enters the church assembly. You hear the clump, clump, clump of the crutch. Clump, ch, clump, ch, clump, ch. He's entering the stone floor, right? Bearing the weight of a person. He awkwardly crosses the room and he finds him a place at the table. He slips into his seat and he uses his hands to lift his useless feet up over to the table, under the table, and he drops them there, and the table spread or tablecloth covers them. It may seem like he's out of place here, but you'd be wrong. That is exactly where he belongs. And now they can eat. It would seem to you, maybe, that there's no way that you could belong at the table of God with the family of God. Your life doesn't seem altogether like everybody else's. It doesn't look put together and flawless like everyone else seems to look. We've all felt this way. And if I were setting the table, if God were asking me, you set the table for the banquet, I'd put a place setting for every person who belongs there. And he would tell me, who is it? Because God knows those who are his. But we all know that the only reason we have a place there at all is because of the grace of the Father who hosts the meal. And I assure you tonight, there is a place for you, and there is room for you, and we would love to see you choose tonight to ask God to set you a place at that table. It will not be because of your looks. It will not be because of your performance. It will not be because of your goodness. It will be because of His grace and your willingness to receive it. His grace is issued. The gospel says, I want you to know you are in my enemy, wrathful glare because of your sin. But I want to look at you with grace and mercy and chesed. I want to offer you a place at the table for the rest of your eternity. I want you to belong with me. But you have to receive it. By faith, you accept it and you say, I believe he wants me there. I believe it with all my heart. I'm going to repent of my sin. I'm going to be immersed in the waters of baptism. And I'm going to rise to let Him be Lord of my life. And at that moment, your place setting is set. It's right there, just awaiting for your arrival. All things are ready. Come to the feast. If you miss out on it, it's not because God didn't want you there. He's telling you, I want you there. Can we set an extra place setting for you. Let's do it tonight. And if you're ready to do that, come, respond, and let's set this place setting. Come and dine with us for eternity. That's what we urge you, and that's what God says to you as we stand and as we sing together.